Short disclaimer. This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldon. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted,
the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat.
Welcome to episode 146 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
Okay, listener feedback for 206 and our discussion of same. Just a few this week. I think we had four. And we're going to start with Kathy.
Hi, ladies. My name is Kathy. I'm calling from Northern Colorado. And I just want to tell you how much I enjoy your podcast. They're very informative, they're very analytical, and they're also really entertaining. I've really gotten a lot out of them. There's some things I missed. There's so much going on in those shows. And I've read the books as well, which I think is really helpful. I'd just like to say that whoever does the casting and finding the actors and whoever, you know, finds the sets, it's just unbelievable what they've done. I think Andrew Gower is fabulous. Simon Callow is amazing. Dominique Pignon is amazing. Sam and Katz and all of them are just fabulous. And of course, Murtaugh as well. Also, I think that the costumes are just unbelievable. The way that Claire's costumes sometimes have a mid-20th century look to them is, to me, it's just so creative. I think Terry Dressbach has just done a fabulous job. The one thing I would say about the show, their second season is so dense. There's so much going on. And I can say is I'm really glad that I have read the books. Otherwise, I think for me, I might be a little bit lost because there's just so much going on. But I think they've done a really good job with the adaption, considering the time constraints. Hopefully we'll have a season three. And again, that's all. But once again, I really enjoy your podcast. So thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Absolutely, Kathy. The costumes, the production, the casting. Yeah. What is there that it's not almost perfection on this production?
I mean, they've been hitting it out of the park since day one, and I fully expect them to continue to do amazing things.
Our next caller is Kelly.
Hi, Ginger and Summer. It's Kelly from California. Howdy, neighbors. First off, I was laughing so hard when Ginger didn't recognize Murtaugh as a fancy French highwayman. The eyebrow acting by Duncan Lacroix was superb, but we all miss them. I miss tons of things that you guys point out every week. I did want to say that I think the reason for Fergus accompanying Jamie is to establish the relationship even more. I mean, of course we need Fergus to be super adorable right before the door closes on the brothel and we all collectively feel sick to our stomachs. So I think the show has done a fairly good job of pointing out that the Comte's likely involvement with the Les Disciples group. The Comte probably knows the group is not involved in the robbery of the wine, and that is why he is so suspicious of Jamie. But he can't come out and say anything for fear of connecting himself to the attack on Mary and Claire, plus who knows how many other criminal activities. So Jamie has put him in a tight spot. And I loved thinking about that and thinking about Jamie's quick and clever mind, if that indeed was his plan. I was sort of irritated at Claire for going to a Real Housewives of Versailles party and expecting some sort of highbrow conversation. I don't know what the point of that was exactly. We don't need it to understand why Claire would go to L'Hôpital. I wanted to point out at the very end of the episode when BJR and Jamie are dueling, and BJR asks Jamie, "How did she forgive you?" I almost stopped breathing, because it really got to the heart of everything, didn't it? That despite all the events Jamie and Claire endure, their love is stronger than even the most depraved act that BGR could ever devise. And he is stunned by it. And that sentence really stuns all of us, I think. Just a few of my thoughts. Thanks again for your podcast. And I look forward to, I don't know if I look forward to this next episode, or maybe we'll both get through it together. Anyway, thanks a lot. Bye.
Thanks, Kelly. Yeah, I understand what you mean. Is it appropriate to say I look forward to something like that? And I actually truly don't even know if I do or would or could or should. Totally, totally understand. I can totally see about having Fergus with Jamie to establish that relationship, especially coming up with what was about to happen at the end of that episode. Also, Lacan's suspicion of Jamie, I think you give good reasoning for that. And that, how did she forgive you? That was...
It was gross.
Yeah, that's...
I mean, it was typical BJR. I mean, I expect nothing better from him.
Blurg. Gross. Next up is Sue.
Just wanted to let you know that 206 was great. The podcast is wonderful. The program itself is great. One of my favorites to watch on TV. I wait every week to see, and I've read all the books. So they're very close to what's going on. And if Starz gets rid of this program, they're going to lose a lot of watchers. So my name is Sue, and I am from South Florida. So this is a great, great program. I mean, I wish to go to Scotland just to see it being filmed. So if they don't leave it on until the end of the books, they would have a mutiny on their hand with the amount of followers. And I belong to the South Florida Outlander Club. So believe me, we are over 1,000 strong just in South Florida. So, and many more to come anyway. Great job. Great, great job. And keep going at this rate. We hope we're getting some kind of awards. We need more. We have to beat Game of Thrones. Okay. Thanks. Have a good day.
Sue, we agree with you. We love the show. We love every aspect of it. And we hope we get all the books as well. Next up, Karen.
Hello, Ginger and Summer. It's Karen from Pennsylvania again. I just listened to your podcast on episode 206 and had a few comments. First of all, loved the episode. I think it really lived up to my expectations as a book reader. I was on the edge of my seat and just heart pounding, even though I knew what happened. But one thing that struck me watching this show that never occurred to me while reading the book, I think that's perhaps the difference when you see it visually, is that the look on Jamie's face at the very end when he's calling out Claire's name perhaps is so anguished because he has possibly come to a conclusion that he has perhaps killed Claire by virtue of ending Frank's existence. And he's smart enough to know that, to figure out that Claire wouldn't be in the 18th century were it not for Frank. And rather than her, you know, disappearing from a Polaroid or just fading away, the 18th century version of that is dying, and that he has perhaps just killed her. He doesn't know that she's losing the child, that, you know, this was going on, you know, before he actually wounded Randall. But the fact that they fall at the same time and then he sees both of them falling, I thought perhaps that's something that might be going on in his mind. Yes, I realize I'm putting a hypothetical situation on an imaginary character, but I'm a little bit of a geek, so I thought that was very interesting and thought you might find it interesting as well. I'll talk to you again. Thanks, guys.
Yes, Karen, I think that absolutely. I mean, he's yelling out her name because he's realizing, oh my gosh, she's here.
Well, he thinks she's dying.
And well, yeah. So first, it's shock of seeing her and realizing that she's in pain or dying or something. And then, of course, probably the baby is like lower on the list because his wife, obviously, that's what he sees is his wife first. And yeah, I mean, the guilt and the shock and the horror and everything. I mean, totally. And you also make a good point, and you had said you're a book reader, so I think I know how and why you made this point, but that yes, Jamie did call the duel, but purposefully did not kill Randall. He could have, he did not. I don't think you're putting a hypothetical situation on an imaginary character. I mean, we both were, but I don't think that you went too far with that, because as I said, I think in the podcast, as we said in our read-along, I don't even know how many months ago now, in the book, it's made clear that she's collapsing and bleeding, or that she feels the tearing, basically the tearing of the baby, of the placenta, at the exact moment that Jack collapses and after and bleeding out through his Balzac. I mean, isn't that where he's hit?
I didn't know there was a Z in sack. Balzac. That's what you said.
I know I did. There's a reason. But I can go into later. But anyway,
right now.
I never actually read the book, but there's a book or an author. I think it's a book called, it's in French, it'll help me better my French. Again, I never read it, so. But Honoré de Balzac, what's his name? B-A-L-Z-A-C, I think. That name always stayed with me. And so I imagined or I think if I want to, not that I want to curse, but if I think of sometimes, like, you know how I'll put in monkey this, monkey that, and I'll just like say other words, or I'll say effort, right? Other words are stand-ins for like a curse word. Sometimes I have been known, at least in my head, I never said it out loud because obviously you never heard that and you just kind of went, oh, that was interesting.
I just thought you were mispronouncing.
No, I wasn't. Nice.
As opposed to pronouncing.
Very good. So ever since then, I internalize that so much that that's one of my things. It's quite rare, but it does happen. I'll say, Honoré de Balzac.
You're so weird.
But anyway, no, I did not say the actual word.
Balls! You and that one word.
Oh, I used to say balls too. But anyway, so yeah. So right when he's bleeding out the Balzac, she's falling. Or when he's stabbed in the Balzac. Yeah, I totally like went there last week, and we went there during our read along. So you're not alone in making observations or saying these things, girl. We got your back. If you're nuts, we're nuts. So, I mean,
nuts, Balzac, Summer. What's going on with you tonight?
Anyway, it sounds perfectly legitimate. Next up is Michael.
Howdy, Ginger. Howdy, Summer. This is Michael from Shawnee, Kansas. And here are my observations from Outlander episode 206. My first point is, how much time had transpired between the end of episode 205 and the beginning of episode 206? During that opening scene, we see Jamie and Murtaugh talking, and the very first time I had watched this episode, I had the sense it was the day after the argument between Jamie and Claire. However, when we get to the next scene with Claire at the hospital, we see that the Baron bump had ballooned significantly. Aren't we use the size of the Baron bump as a guide to see how much time had passed? If we are, it would have been helpful for me during that opening scene as a supplement if Murtaugh would have included something along the lines like, we've been waiting patiently for that bastard Randall to get out of the Bastille. My second point is the angst I felt towards the end of the episode when Jamie returned to Madame Lee's, taking young Fergus with him. I was silently screaming at the TV when young Fergus started walking down the hall and entering the room. And, well, I think Summer and Ginger did an excellent job describing what we saw in that room. My two favorite moments from the podcast are, first, the reference to the Princess Bride with the comparison of Prince Charles to the impressive clergyman. The Princess Bride is my favorite movie of all time, and the fact that I failed to make that connection myself is simply
inconceivable!
My other favorite moment from the podcast is when Summer pointed out to Ginger that Murtaugh was indeed a highwayman. To me, he doesn't look like Willie Nelson or Johnny Cash, but he was one of the highwaymen, and I caught the look between Jamie and Murtaugh right before Murtaugh knocked him out. Lastly, I wonder if the show watchers have the same question I had when I read Dragonfly about BJR's groin injury during the duel. Can he sire a child? And if he can't, then what?
Think it'll work?
It would take a miracle.
Thanks, Michael. We also love The Princess Bride, so glad that you enjoyed those references. And your question or wondering about BJR's groin injury, I think it is something that people wondered about, and it's very fair to hold that as a question, but I would tell those who are watching the series only and who haven't read the books, hold it as a very valid question, and we'll see. We'll find out. And next is Margaret.
Hi, Ginger and Summer. This is Margaret from the North Georgia Mountains. First of all, I wanted to say you ladies have way too much fun doing your podcast. Just completed listening to your podcast on Best Laid Schemes, and I had a couple of thoughts. When Jamie and Claire are talking about her promise to go back to Frank if something bad happened, I think part of Claire's reaction may have to do with the fact that she had that conversation with Master Raymond where he indicated that she would see Frank again, and I think it's kind of heading home that stuff's getting real. My second thought was when Claire was conversing with the ladies after dinner and brought up her concern about the poor and women and children in the streets of Paris. And basically my thought on that was Claire doesn't have enough on her plate with trying to stop the Jacobites and trying to keep Frank alive. Now she wants to stop the French Revolution. Bless her heart. No wonder she's so frustrated. Love your podcast and look forward to this next one. Thanks.
Margaret, you make a very interesting point about Claire hearing twice now. First, Raymond saying that she will see this person, this man again, this male, and then Jamie getting her to promise him to go back to Frank if something goes sideways at a certain point. That conversation with Raymond was added to the series, so it's definitely something that I had not thought of before or connected, but since they were so close together, then they're, I think you're right, they're obviously fresh in her mind. So I think that's a very good point. She's not only kind of bowled over that Jamie is thinking about this, but also that it's kind of probably freaking her out that Raymond made this statement, this pronouncement, and now Jamie's getting her to promise this. So she, I think you're right, she's kind of seeing her own little view of the possible future, and it's a scary one. And finally, Erica.
Hello, Ginger and Summer. This is Erica from Joburg. I have many things to say about best laid schemes. Goodness, that sounded very ominous. I loved it, actually. If I had to rate it, I would give it a solid 90%. Fractions of 100 are the best, I find. One of the best lines of the episode goes to the butler, Magnus, when he says, too damn bad to Myrta. The line itself isn't funny, but in context, I just did not expect it. I think I might have snorted my tea accidentally. And Myrta, like Myrta and Claire and Myrta and Jamie and Myrta and Suzette. Just Myrta and everyone. Like, seriously, I want a Myrta. Because let's be honest, everyone needs a Myrta. Another thing I really liked were these little character moments, like when Claire comes home from the L'Hôpital and all the servants are like shifty, like side-eyeing each other. And Suzette's like, Madame, can I feed you? Do you want to bathe? Please don't inquire as to the whereabouts of your husband. And little Roman Baru is just the best. I don't know how to pronounce that in French. Baru, I don't know, but he's the best. And I really love the duel at the end between Jamie and Jack. It was just choreographed really well, and it was very gritty. Very cool. Kudos as ever to the acting. I'm going to stop mentioning that because it's now that's just redundant to mention that. The entire final scene kind of left me feeling a little bit dead inside, guys. One nitpick I did have was how fast Jamie and Claire made up. You know, it was a... I felt a little whiplash, you know, to steal a phrase from you guys. Granted, it wasn't Dragonfly and Amber level whiplash, but, you know, whatever. As long as Claire and Jamie are okay, which they're not. Ish. Next episode, probably going to trample all over our little hearts, guys. Good luck with that. Okay, bye.
Oh, Erica, how right you are. Magnus had that line when he said to Myrta, too damn bad. And of course, Myrta was walking away, so he potentially didn't hear him. And of course, the duel. The choreography was great, acting, delivery of the lines, everything. So, so effective. And now, on to the 207. So, we're here. It's episode 207 discussion time.
We knew it was coming.
Well, it does come after 206, and we had to do it before we can talk about 208. So, do we just jump in?
I mean, there's no other way to do it.
Okay. So, episode 207 is entitled Faith. In the opening title, it's, I think, one of the episodes or the episode that Tony Graffia was referring to when she said there's another episode with an interesting opening title that is not just like a still scene, right?
Right.
And I'm thinking it's this episode.
It could, very well could be.
Could be another one. Who knows? But this one is at least a contender. So, opening title. It is 1954 Boston. And we have a baby Bree.
Not really a baby.
No, but she's not Sophie Skelton, so she's baby Bree. Baby-ish Bree. Baby young, me think younger of
like
Bree.
Baby Belle, like the cheese.
Baby Belle. Those are delicious.
You just said that's so weird.
Okay. Well, we got it I almost said got it on tape. We got it on audio, so listeners can enjoy that or not as well. So there are books on a table. They are nature books. And the one that the camera kind of spent the most time on as it glided over the table was called Shoreland Summer Diary by C.F. Tunnicliffe. Now, of course, I had to look it up. That's Charles Frederick Tunnicliffe, an internationally renowned naturalist painter of British birds and other wildlife. Now, this girl whom we find out is Brianna.
Well, we find out that it's her daughter. They said no names.
It's Claire's daughter. She's got copper hair, and it's in 54, a number of years after she came back, admittedly pregnant, through the stones, without Jamie. And it's not Frank's kid. Those are all things we know from episode one.
Yes.
So it's looking good that it might be that baby that we don't necessarily know yet. It's a young girl with long, curly copper hair, and she calls Claire Mama. And she's looking at the picture of a blue heron in one of the nature books in front of her. And although people may have, probably will have, differing opinions, she has an American accent.
Oh, for sure.
Thank you, Jesus. You guys don't understand. Sorry, I just had to say that. Okay.
Okay.
There's a reason I just did that little vocal dance, and I can explain it maybe one
y'all,
day.
There was an actual dance. You just didn't get to see it.
No. So.
It was a chair dance. Not a lap dance. A chair
dance. Oh, well, yeah. So Claire is made up beautifully. She's got a pearl necklace on and pearl earrings, and her makeup is beautiful. And she's got on orange nail polish. Now, this is the first time we see, at least in this episode, orange. And she's wearing blue.
There's a lot Bree, of blue.
A lot of blue. Bree is also wearing blue. She's on...
For the record, I am also wearing blue.
And I am wearing purple and teal. But my mic is blue.
It is.
She's... Now, all of that, most of that, I got through watching and taking notes as it progressed. The next few are ones that I added when we got to the very end. I went back and I said, oh, I'm going to put this up there on my notes for the opening title. When she's with Bree, or this child, she's kneeling down at the table next to her. She's on the young child's right. And it's her right hand that we see the orange nail polish on that comes up to the table. Her lipstick also has kind of a tinge of orange. It's not straight up purple.
That might be your screen.
There's even more. No, I don't think it's my screen.
Her lips didn't look orange to me.
No, not orange, but almost like a coral. They weren't bright red and they weren't pink. It was an orangey pink or orangey red. That's all I'm saying. So basically, pay attention to the color blue and potentially the color orange. And there's an animal that has been pointed out to us. A bird. A great blue heron.
I Googled it, by the way.
You want to talk about it?
Yep.
Oh, do it, because I did not. So go for it.
Yes. So...
That was sweet.
It was so specific that if you're going to mention a bird, that I was like, there has to be a reason. Nobody just randomly picks a great blue heron because it's never really mentioned again in the entire episode. So I put my ginger hat on and I decided that I would.
And she had to, I struggled because she like ripped some hair out.
I did. She did not give it to me willingly, but I took it nonetheless. That being said, I went and I looked it up and I had to go to a few different sites, but I found out that in Egyptian mythology, a heron would guide the souls of the dead to the land of the dead. So that's the significance of a heron. So they are guiding the souls to the afterlife.
And it's blue.
And it is blue.
Or at least it's, yeah.
But, and she said the last time she saw one was in Scotland. So, which, not to say that she didn't see one in France, because she probably did.
Oh, she did.
Symbolically. But they are... That's what I found out about blue herons.
So then the episode proper starts. We are in Paris at L'Hôpital des Anges. Claire is on a bed, and Monsieur Foret is doing his best to treat her. Mother Hildegard is comforting her, and nuns, or at least one nun, is praying for her.
It was Sister Angelique, I believe.
Yes.
She's token nun. Hildegard, it's her. And can I just say, if I had a choice of who I would want delivering my baby, I don't think the king's executioner would be my first choice.
No. No. And she's losing a lot of blood. Well, she already was losing blood before she got there, but she's losing more blood. It's quite a bloody situation there.
It is, and none of that blood is in her face. Like, she is so
She's so pale. And she's calling out for Jamie and her baby. She sees the heron again, or at least we're shown one. So that would be Faith.
Probably.
And then I wrote, man, that aerial view, just when they cut away and they're going to go back to, well, it's still L'Hôpital, but it's the next day. As they kind of go away from that shot, there's the aerial view of her, her legs covered. She's totally covered up with her dress, but her legs are up and bent and to the side.
Well, they didn't have stirrups.
No, I get it. But it's just like such a vulnerable position. I don't know what to say. That's like, it's all there. And because he has to get access to a uterus, he has to take care of what's being taken care of.
It's true. It reminds me of being in the stirrups at the lady doctor, where you just like, you try to zone out. You don't want to be anywhere but there. You're not present. And there's nothing else to do. You just lie on your back. And as Claire says later, think of England.
And so the next day or sometime later, they're still at L'Hôpital. She's in bed, shivering now. So we know she's likely got that fever. She's awake and she's wondering what's going on. She sees the statue of the Virgin Mary. Actually, that could be a reference of a few things. Reference of mother, reference of a mother who lost a child, reference of the color blue, and reference to the Madonna. She feels her stomach, and she feels she can tell her baby's gone, at least no longer in her, and she becomes frantic. Mother Hildegard tells her that the baby, has joined the angels, and that the baby was mort-né, or stillborn. This scene is hard. I mean, it's sad because of what it is, but Frances de la Tour it made me cry just to watch her, when she was so compassionate, so comforting, as much as she could be helping they're helping her friend who just lost her baby. I loved both her and Claire Sermon in this episode. They were just gentle there. They did what they needed to do, and so effective. Like, less is more, right? So effective. Claire looks unbelieving. She refuses to believe Mother Hildegard. And Sister Angelique offers Claire the statue of Mary to comfort her. She says, look at the statue, or think of the mother. She will help comfort or help heal you.
Because she lost a baby too.
Exactly. And Claire insists on seeing her baby. Now they struggle, and as they struggle, the statue is knocked off its pedestal and it shatters. So here we have someone who has been offered as healing or a healer is broken and shattered. So that's, again, very symbolic. Claire, we learn, has a bad fever. We find out that Mother Hildegard baptized the baby in order to be able to bury her on holy ground. And she named her Faith. The priest is called because Claire is so ill to give her final unction, or what used to be called last rites.
I would literally have lost all faith in my caregivers that they had given up on me. If they're like, we brought in the priest because we can't do anything else.
It's for healing. It's not because, we think you're a lost cause. Although maybe they thought that, but also at that time, you didn't have drugs, not like today. And you did what you could. And then you said, okay, well, go with God, right? Because what else? At a Catholic hospital.
It's true. But what I'm saying is that as a healer, not me personally, but if I were Claire and I'm ill and I'm in a bed, if they stop sending doctors to me and they start sending priests, I know that they've given
the tie
up.
Has
They're
changed.
Done. Yeah.
So still no word from Jamie, she says. And when offered or when asked if she'd like to make a final confession, she says her sins are all she has left. So Mother Hildegard has Bouton stay by her side on the bed, but there's no popping dog farts.
Which
is totally okay. It would have ruined the movie.
But that would have been so open to interpretation, because who decides what a popping dog fart sounds like?
If it was a voiceover from Claire, there's no interpretation. It's Claire's interpretation.
No, but she would not have had to voice over that. He would have just done it.
I know, but the funny thing was, it was that this is Claire in the book. Claire kind of almost outside of herself, right? Listening but seeing the roof, not the roof, seeing the ceiling and basically observing. Mm-hmm. Kind of not quite out of body experience, but a very surreal experience. And then when this dog fart comes, it's like, okay then. And life goes on. So as it grows dark, Master Raymond appears. Just like in the book, he begins to heal her by the laying on, literally laying on of hands. And he calls her Madonna. And he says to her, right when he starts, "Tell me what you see, Madonna." And she says that she sees a blue bird, of course. She says blue wings. And he tells her blue is the color of healing and that the wings will carry her pain away. Then she goes through and talks about how she can feel the infection dying within her and she feels herself getting better. And she says, this is directly from the book. I loved it. She felt, quote, each scintilla of infection disappeared. I love this. Now, I got a question. In the book, and it's not maybe clear or maybe I'm not remembering. In the book, the final thing he did to heal her was to put his hand or fingers or something inside of her, right? To heal her womb.
Yes.
Now, was that I apologize if this is crass. Was that a hand, a finger, some fingers, whatever it was?
In the book, I don't think they were clear, but he clearly shoved his hand up there because he pulled out stuff.
Okay. So, okay, fair enough. So when she was going like, oh, Jamie, that was flipping pain.
Yeah.
Okay. Because I was wondering if it, and maybe in the book it was different, but trying to remember by her reaction and then my memory of the story, was it, she was not aroused?
No.
Okay. I didn't think God, she no. was. I didn't think she was. I just was like, she's like going awful far for this. And I'm like, okay, when he throws that thing down, you're like, okay,
in part of her voiceover, she said that there was a piece of the placenta they didn't get that was festering inside of her. So my only conclusion I can draw from this is he reached up inside of her hoo-ha and pulled the rest of the festering placenta out, and that's what he had in his hand. But can I also tell you that for him to have had his hands up there to remove that placenta and then duck around the corner, he had it in his hand. I don't know what he did with it.
I thought he threw it down.
I don't know what he did with it. I don't know where it went. They did not show us that. However, that being said, he turned around, hides because people are coming. Then he comes back, totally clean hands. Where did he wipe?
Blood?
What did he wipe his hands on?
Well, if he's magic enough to heal her, he's magic enough to clean his hands magically. So
he makes bones disappear in cups. He makes blood disappear off his hands.
He puts poison in chalices.
Yes.
That's a whole other thing that I think that rocked my world, but that's later on. Okay. So my question is, okay, she wasn't aroused at all. I didn't think she was, but I was like, what is that? I want to make sure I'm not understanding this incorrectly.
I did not read that as pleasure, even a little
bit. Not pleasure. Well, okay. Here's the biggest difference. He did not tell her to call her Red Man.
Well, he never called him the Red Man though. In the book, he called him that before.
No, that's what I'm saying.
He made Viking overtones, but they've never even seen each other.
Oh, I get it. You're right. So that he wouldn't have known the color of his hair.
Right.
He wouldn't have known that necessarily. But yeah, okay, he wouldn't have known.
Nope.
So I have a question.
Oh God, here we go.
I understand.
Yes.
I think it's sweet, the whole bird thing and the symbolism of the blue heron and carrying away or accompanying the souls of the dead.
Yes.
Okay, I don't have a problem with that. It's new. It's sweet. I can go for it. But it's been now related. Okay, blue has been related correctly to healing. To healing, to Claire's power as a healer or to Claire being a healer, mm-hmm. and her color of her aura or whatever. He didn't say the word aura, but he said the color about her. So her aura.
Right.
Her color, as is his. So they can't, I'm trying to read into this. They're not suggesting that whenever some healing happens in the future, if some healing happens in the future, that we're going to see a blue heron, because they specifically said the heron was related. Not, they didn't say this. Well, he did. That it was related to carrying away the souls of the dead or accompanying them.
Well, he didn't say that. I read that in a book. I read that online.
Oh, that's right. He said it would take away your pain.
Yes.
Okay. So all we know from them is it's the whole pain relation.
Yes.
Or getting rid of pain. Okay. So then my question is still valid. Thank God they didn't get rid of the blue. Fair enough. That's easy enough to not get rid of. Does that mean if we get all the books, there's no blue light?
I mean, I can't say one way or the other, but she was out of her gosh darn mind and she wasn't looking at his hands, really.
They showed us his hands all over.
Well, most of his real healing was done inside, and I don't think they have any lights inside her hoo-ha.
That is true. But the fact that they brought a bird into it made me think that's going to be the shtick.
We'll see.
For all the books, it's going to be blue and a blue bird. Not a blue bird, but a bird that's blue. A blue heron, whatever. Which is lovely. It's very romantical.
It's probably cheaper too.
than doing CGI.
Yeah.
Just have a shot of a bird flying over.
Use the same one.
That's true. But there was one nice effect tonight that freaked me the freak out when I first, I was like, oh my God, how did they do that? Oh my God.
Right.
Okay, we'll go on. So he heals her. Now, I'm asking you, Summer, without the blue light, will people understand, this is a silly question, that he's kind of magical in some way?
I think that goes without saying. He just made her fever go away with his hands.
Good.
Because literally, from the outside, without her voiceover, he just touched her, like, on her shoulders and then, like, down her body and reached inside of her and made her fever go away.
Okay.
If that's not magic, I don't know what else is.
Okay. He calls her Madonna again, and she says she's no longer with child. He corrects her. He says, I call you Madonna because your color is blue, like her cloak, like my color. Raymond says to her, quote, these are things you do for your friends. And then he says, we will see each other again. Have faith. Like, well,
very soon.
Sorry.
Sooner than
she
later.
Doesn't have faith.
Aw, that's bad.
I know. Couldn't believe they did it. They left it in there. And then he calls Bouton over and has him get back on the bed.
I love, like, that Bouton is just like, okay.
Sure. Let's go. I'll go back up there.
They're just like, that would be like a buddy-buddy movie.
I want to know, to me, that shows, I mean, he's not necessarily a guard dog. He's like a sniffer dog, right? But a healer sniffer. But there has to be a story.
Title?
There has to be a story. I know they're like different side of the tracks, but there has to be a story where Mother Hildegard and Master Raymond like hang. In the book,
I want them to go on a road trip together.
A what?
A road trip.
Oh, an 18th century road trip?
Yeah, it'd be hilarious.
A carriage trip?
Think of how much fun it could be. They'd be
throw in Murtaugh, it would be.
And with Bouton in the middle?
Oh my gosh. Oh, that would be the best.
Put him on a wagon. It'll be awesome.
So Mother Hildegard returns and she says it's a miracle that her fever is broken. Claire finds out that Jamie was arrested after or because of the duel and is still at the Bastille.
Is it just me or is Mother Hildegard the most well-informed nun ever?
She knows a lot of people in a lot of places. She's the goddaughter of the two previous kings ago.
Yeah.
Something like that.
But that does, you know, that explanation only goes so far. Because that's like being that two previous kings ago. And she lives in a convent. The odds are she does not.
She's from a witch family. I don't know if they explain that in the book.
A witch family?
She's from a witch family. She's
my
from.
Witch. My witch is what brings us.
Finish it and do it correctly.
Together today.
Nope. How did I do it last time? Together today.
No, I don't do that.
Yes, you can. So she also finds out that BGR is not dead. Dun, dun, dun. Dude. And he's been able to return to England to recover. She calls him the cat with nine lives. So Frank is then alive. She's pissed off at Jamie, and she tells Mother Hildegard so. She says that revenge mattered more to Jamie than Claire or his own child. And she hates him right now.
Well, she does. But we have to temper that with the fact that, to this point, she's alone in her grief. And the one person who should be there to share it with her is not there. So, I mean, all of her family, Jamie.
The baby.
Everyone that she's been associating with, that she's been day in, day out meeting and spending time with while she's been in France, none of them are coming to L'Hôpital. So she's literally alone. She, you know, it's like as a woman who, you know, when you go into the hospital and you're pregnant, you expect
a baby.
And then when you leave, to take that baby with you. And, you know, you start to
whole new phase. And typically in the hospital, you've got family or friends surrounding you almost the whole time. Except for maybe like the pushing part.
Right. As we see later, Louise did come.
Yeah.
But
there was a reason she came.
Correct.
I think. And I think a certain mère called her. So at Jared's in Paris, Claire is returning home, basically. Her quote-unquote home she has right now. She's returning to Jared's. So they didn't do Fontainebleau. No Louise to help her heal. That's okay. It's just an adaptation. This scene, okay. So the scene where she gets out of the carriage, first with Fergus with the flowers. And I was wondering what type of flowers they were. I didn't like.
They were purple.
They were purple flowers. So beautiful. And it's so slow. It's so sad. It's so beautiful.
Before you speak, was this new music? This
I
was
think
not
so.
Okay, because I'm calling this Faith's theme because they played it several times in the episode.
It may have been. Did it match what they played at the very end?
Yes.
Then it was.
It's like he scored the sound of someone crying. Like it was.
Stop it. First, no, don't stop it. Keep going. It's okay. But ladies and gentlemen, if summer started, then you know that I'm going to be there pretty soon. But the robot has broken. Summer said to me, and we don't talk about stuff before we come because we want it to be authentic here. And I watched it and I came out of my office and I was like, Summer is so good. Oh my God. And I'm like, you know, the end or the scene where blah, blah, blah. And she's like, oh yeah, I know it. But that's not the one that broke me. The one that broke me was when Claire came home and was getting out of the carriage.
Sorry, I need a minute.
It's okay. And this is okay. So Summer said he scored this someone crying.
Yes, it was this melody, the notes that are all cascading downward, and it would go to his point and then it would start over again. And it was like if they just had one person's face, it would have been one tear.
Tears, yeah.
And then another tear. And then it was just, oh, it was so perfect.
And what I did write was Bear's music is just beautiful here. It's gentle, sad, hints of both minor and major. And it seemed, I wrote, it's a question. It's a musical question. I agree. I could definitely see it as tears. It's definitely sad, but because of its major elements, it's going to be like almost cruel. What I'm about to say, you could definitely see the sadness in it or hear the sadness in it, but you could also maybe say because of moments of major, see the happiness of having that child. The sadness of not having the child, even though the child's not there. Like, I don't know. It wasn't like laughter, like a baby's laugh, but it was like the happiness of your baby. But then the sadness of this idea, this being, this creature, this spirit that was no longer there.
And I think what made this scene the hardest one for me was because she'd been alone in the hospital in this. And then she comes home.
And everybody's there waiting for
and
her.
And everyone's... ridiculous right now. We're literally sitting crying together and then everyone's waiting for her and they're all standing there and it's like
no one wants to say anything. No one knows what to say.
What do you say?
But how they all like bow for her and it's like a welcome. She's not a queen, but it was a welcome, a recognition of
it was
this person,
right? And then the look on Katrina's face when she gets out of that carriage,
she's just unsure of herself
and she just, it was like trauma. It was just like, I don't know what to do. It was so perfect. Like, it was such a beautifully played scene. Mm-hmm.
And then Suzette breaks down. That was awful to watch. And then Claire does. So Claire's like, I'm trying to hold it together. I'm here. I'm alone. Like Summer said, slowly coming down. And again, she's wearing blue. And Suzette comes up and I forget what the words she uses are, but she breaks down. And then when she sees that, Claire breaks down. And then when Claire gets to Magnus and then when she then basically bows and kisses his hand, that was almost too much. And she says, thank you. Thank you for what? Just for welcoming her? For
he took care of her. He took her to L'Hôpital.
Yeah.
And he got her safely there. He did what she asked. He took her to the Bois de Boulogne, whatever it's called.
Yeah, you got it right.
Thank you. He took her to the Duel. He got her to the Duel. Like, he went against everything he knew and did what she asked and took her where she needed to go. And then when everything went to pot, he got her safely to the hospital and had her taken care of and did everything he could.
Yeah.
And
now this is going to sound a little hokey, but the way she reacted to him and said thank you and all of that, the first thing I thought of, I didn't get the word until just now when we were talking, but the sense of it I got while watching it from the first time I saw it, and that was, I am not the most consistent practitioner, but I am an inconsistent practitioner of yoga. And one of the things I learned, my very first, I guess, stint, my first class, I took it for a summer in college many years ago. And Summer was there. She took most of classes there. And you learn the word, you don't have to say it, but we learn the word namaste. And what I had learned, the first way I heard namaste translated or explained was when you acknowledge someone with namaste, you're saying, I see or I honor the God or the presence of God in you. So when you're saying that to someone, it is kind of a wish of peace, but you're saying, I honor the holy in you. And so that was the sense that I got, that I know she's not bowing down to him or anything like that.
No, but if you remember, she stopped him from bowing to her, first of all.
Yeah.
And then she bowed to him. So it wasn't just...
That's another very, even though she's a female, that's another very Christ-like moment where she's like, no, 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 let me do this for you. You know, it's this dude, I don't know how. We will put it out there. Tony Graffia, we need you back because this, we had a strong idea that this would be your episode and we're pleasantly surprised or happy that it was. But, and I know there was the director and the actors, everybody brings it. Everybody brings it. But you have absolutely outdone yourself with this one because there were so many opportunities and there was excitement too. That's why it was such an interesting episode. But it breaks you. There's a little bit of laughter.
Oh my God. Thank
ton of symbolism.
God. Thank God for the king.
I know.
For that scene, because I could not have taken the front to back
of faith.
Of just faith. Like I needed that respite.
Lightheartedness.
And
yeah.
Lighthearted though it was. Even the comp scene and the star scene.
Yeah, yeah.
I needed that whole section
in the middle
to just take a breath.
She needed that, yes, to breathe and to dry her face.
Because the first like 20 minutes of this episode, I was just a wreck. I was a mess. It was bad. And then you know, she comes back from...
Oh, shut up.
She comes back from the castle and then it starts
all
over again.
And then Jamie gets back. And then it's that, to me, that was the hardest scene at the end. We'll get to that. And I wrote, she becomes a bit like the Virgin Mary. So she's wearing blue here, a blue cloak, and she's comforted by all. And then the next scene, she's in her room, the fire is going, and Fergus is combing her hair. And that is straight up out of the books. I mean, again, I...
What did she say? Thank you, Fergus. That felt nice.
Yeah.
That was...
Yeah.
Part of me felt that was disingenuous. Like she's like, okay. Thank you. That was nice.
It's like, okay, I know you're trying. That's sweet. Fergus seems to be triggered by some bottle of scent or something on Claire's dressing table. And he kind of like says, oh, okay. And he like takes off. Later that night, Claire is alone in her room in her shift. And she sees the box of apostle spoons. She, of course, breaks down, gets angry and closes it and shoves them under the bed. Sorry, this is the point she breaks down. And she goes into the hallway and to keep her stuff together mostly, right? She's like muffling her face and she's crying, but not, she's sobbing, but she's not wailing. She's not making a lot of noise. Her dressing gown is blue. I think when she wears dresses or clothing, other than her under things, obviously her shift was white or linen or whatever. I think it's mostly, not all, but mostly blue this episode. And she hears Fergus having a nightmare, yelling, stop! S'il vous plaît. So she goes to him, but...
Did you think that was weird that he said stop in English?
No, because he'd already spoken English to them, and he knew it was an English officer.
No, for sure. I'm just saying that...
Oh, in his dream?
In his dream, for him to, like, scream out in English. I thought that was a little...
I don't know.
Strange.
Strange. So she goes to him and says, it's okay, it's just a dream. And he says, it wasn't only a dream. We learn just what happened to him.
And this was everything we didn't want to see in the last episode that we kind of got to see. I almost
wish it could have been worse.
It could have, but I almost wish that it had just been him retelling it without
seeing it.
Yeah.
So there's the Englishman, and he had wanted to take the lavender oil to Milady, and he pockets it, and he gives it to her right at that moment. It was under his pillow. And he recounts the scene, and... Randall had come into the room and said, you're not what I ordered, but you'll do.
Gross.
And then, of course, he's raped. And with all the little, I get it, he's an actor, he does his job very well. Little little Fergus, actor did really good job. But dude, Tobias, that man has no freaking fear. No fear. What? Do I think he would do his job? Yes. And I'm sure they had talks about the scene to let him, you know, so everyone felt comfortable. And of course, there was no actual, thank goodness, Tobias Wiener coming out. But I mean, not for the camera. But
I'm sure there's some sort of a law against having an adult male penis in the same room with a child.
With a child.
Movie or no movie. I'm fairly sure.
I'm glad you said that. Thank goodness. But my point is, even... Like, imitating that act. That's no joke.
I know.
Tobias.
It was not cool.
Well, we know that from the book, but I mean, when he shows up and he's like, you're not what I ordered, but you'll do. He's like, he does not even think twice. He does not think twice. And then it's awful is what it is. And then he starts to struggle and everything. And then when he yells out and he says, what breaks my heart is when he says, Milord, because that's like, you know,
she just mouthed the F word. You should just said effer. You do that.
I
know. Lot.
I do. Of course, then Claire learns the reason for the duel. I wrote, note, no brand. At least at this point, there's no brand. It may come back, but it's been like weeks now. I think it would have probably been healed. Poor Fergus. And he didn't get
a chance to brand him.
That's true. He was found out and taken out. So Fergus, it's a child, and he's a child who takes on, as all children will do, either when they get in trouble or when they think they may get in trouble, or when they're trying to not get in trouble, or when something's done to them and they think they had a part in it, they don't understand. He was taking that responsibility on himself, and he says it's all his fault. And of course, that makes it more heartbreaking. And he says, as he's crying on the bed, he says, I didn't know he'd fight the Englishman. So he blames himself for the Englishman, first of all, because, I shouldn't have been in there to take it. I should have listened to Milord. But he also blames himself for the duel. And it's, I mean, even that much more tragic.
Well, because I shouldn't have been in there. I shouldn't have done this. He told me not to do this. Mm-hmm. And then he was like, well, once I was in there, I should have just been quiet. I shouldn't have made any noise.
Because then Mila... I know.
Because then he wouldn't have come in there.
Each layer is just breaking your heart more. So back at L'Hôpital.
This conversation in the book happened with Louise, did it not?
No. It had to do... It was with... Louise may have been present, but Mother Hildegard was there because she expressed her discontent with the whole thing about having to lie with the king.
Okay.
I think it was at L'Hôpital, though, because Mother doesn't really leave L'Hôpital, right? Not that we know of. So she meets with Mother Hildegard regarding getting an audience with the king. She's
I thought you were going to say getting it on with the king.
Oh, no. Now, she's not wearing blue here. She's wearing kind of a salmony orange. So remember I mentioned orange?
You did.
So far, we've only seen orange in Claire's...
Fingernails in the 50s?
Fingernails and like a touch of like orange-ish. Orange red or orange pink, whatever it was, on her lips. It wasn't orange, but it was orangey. And she learns from Mother Hildegard, quote, there is a price to such requests. She may have to lie with the king. And Claire says she's basically willing to sacrifice her virtue if it means getting her husband back. Then, the next scene, we're at Versailles. And I wrote, that was quick. They don't waste any time. She gets to go. She's wearing, now there is green in it, but she's wearing a blue dress.
Yes.
Very, like, royal blue dress. Also, that's a long arse walk to get to the king's chamber. It never ended.
Well, it's a really big place.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
It's like you don't enter a door right next to his bedroom.
And then I wrote in all caps, she's wearing the necklace.
Well, if she wore it to her own dinner party, of course she's going to wear it out to Versailles. Kings. Come on.
So Louis looks very nice, as always. And he's one of the dudes who looks really good in a wig.
He does. But I'm sorry, I can't unsee him pooping on the toilet in the first episode he was in. I cannot unsee that. He will always be the guy struggling to poop.
He offers Claire hot chocolate and an orange.
No, he offered her warm chocolate.
Oh, show. Show means hot.
But he said warm. It said warm in the...
In the French, in the it subtitle. Was show, which is hot. Now, if I'm totally off my cracker rocker, then please let me know, just French saying, speakers.
It was the subtitle. The subtitle said warm chocolate.
I understand. And again, the color orange with the orange.
Orange, man. I have lots to say about that orange. I was cracking up.
Oh, at the end?
Well, even before that, it's like he hands it to her and she's like, oh, sure, why not? And then she's like, what am I supposed to do with this now?
Yeah.
It's not like she's going to peel it. I'm like, I know. She's holding on to it.
What I was thinking was, oh my gosh, not hot chocolate, but chocolate and oranges are like one of the best combinations. I wonder if she's going to like peel it and take a bite and then take a sip. But none of that happened.
No. But it was funny because she was just held it. Just, I'm going to hold this orange. And then he's like, let's go to the other room. And she's like, what? I'll just put that there.
Yeah. So she puts forth her request for Jamie's release. Now, it's interesting. The king brings up her two rings, about her two husbands, right? And he remarks, your loyalty is most noteworthy. This whole time, she's looking over at the bed.
With his accent, it almost sounded like, your loyalty is most not worthy. It almost sounded like he said not worthy.
Yeah.
Even then, I had to listen to it a couple more times, but he does say noteworthy. So this whole time, as I said, she's kind of like making eye, not googly eyes, but like making eyes, weird eyes at the bed going, it was okay, it's going to happen. No, but she's like, is this going to happen now? What do I need to do?
Well, and they were sitting right opposite it. Like, it's right in front of her face.
Yeah. And then he pops up with, quote, I am inclined toward mercy, but tell me, if I was to grant your request to free your husband, would you be inclined to grant me a small favor in return? And she says, I am at your majesty's complete disposal. I think her line is exactly from the book. It sounds like it. But they don't go to the bed. He caresses her face and says, I can see why they call you La Dame Blanche.
He said it kind of in a sinister way, though.
Yeah.
Like.
And he, exactly. Like, and that actually follows wrong. What I'm about to say. Here the music gets ominous. And he takes her hand and they start to walk toward the door. Oh, no, he doesn't take, he walks and then he leads her. And the king takes her to a magical Mr. Mephistopheles. No, just kidding. Just kidding. It's some really cool room with occult symbols on the walls, pillars, torches, candles. Amazing.
Did anyone else not think that was strange?
That just, boom, we're going to be in this room?
No, that for a king who is like basically having a witch hunt. Looking for occult members to take him to a room for the occult.
That's why I don't think that change works, right? The change for Fauré. Remember what I said last week or 2 weeks ago? I think it was last week. If you're going to say the king is out for blood because he wants to rid Paris or rid France of people who practice the dark arts, it doesn't make sense.
He has his own occult room.
Well, yeah. Well, yes. I can... Yes. The bigger thing about why it didn't make sense was less of the king, but more of, well, it was out of character for the king, kind of, but made more sense or made less sense. It was more important that it didn't make sense because of Fauré, right? In the way that was transmitted, rather than it being about being a traitor, it was about the dark arts. I do see how they meant it to set up a warning so that next week or weeks, which was this week, 207, that the warning for her / Raymond would go through. So I can see that how they, I can see their intention, and then Fauré being there kind of brought it home. So mm-hmm. I can see that once you're having him be your deliverer, having him there. I do get that. But I think having the king have this room that was his own and have all this stuff going on, it just didn't follow. That changed. I guess it was effective they brought it back around, but Fauré didn't need to be there. He didn't do anything.
Well, especially if
no one was going to be killed.
If he was planning on killing them with a serpent, you don't need an executioner for that.
Thank you. It was interesting having him there, but, you know, whatever.
That was just to drive the point home that death was happening in that day.
That's fair. So then she sees Fauré, and in the voiceover, she says she knew that there would likely be a death today, that day. So Raymond and Le Comte are brought in and accused.
Their faces when they walk in the room and see Claire are so
priceless.
Between like Raymond, who's like a little bit kind of like just confused. Whereas when the Comte comes in, he's like, oh, F you. He's like, he's like, this is it. He's like, I don't know how I'm in out of this one.
Not as she either. So Raymond and the Comte are brought in and accused of taking part in the dark arts or practicing the dark arts. And the king is basically saying, Madame Fraser is La Dame Blanche, and La Dame Blanche can see into the hearts of men and find evil and truth. And I love that when she's like, just like you said about what Raymond's like, oh no, the Comte's like, oh, MFG, what the what? Same thing on her face when she finds out her role. She says, Jesus H. Roosevelt Christ.
Yeah.
It's like, great. I mean, really. And the king asks her to tell which of the men is evil. She looks at Raymond, thinking possibly, what the heck, little dude? You were supposed to leave the city. Now, like, I got to do something here. I love the way she puts her hand up to her face. Like, she's like some magical, oh.
No.
That cracked me up.
And then everyone else's faces when she did that, because they were just like, what are you doing?
It was so 20th century.
No. My favorite, though, is then when the comp just like straight up says, I know she's a witch because I poisoned her. And I'm like,
I know. I know. Like, I it's know. Like, oh, you just dropped that bomb.
I was like,
Okay, I love the way she put, as I said, puts her hand up to her face, and of course she sees a shadow behind the Comte's face. Stanley does this entire scene so well. He's good at comedy. He's a good comedy actor. He's unbelievable in that he's disbelieving, and of the situation, he's like, I cannot believe this right now. He's very haughty, as his character always is. And he, as Summer said, he did poison her, and he calls her a witch, and she owns her witchiness, but she says she practices white magic.
Right, and at this point, I'm thinking, careful, Claire. The king never...
The king made eyes at you. He did say, Madame Fraser is not on trial today, but girlfriend... He's got that in his back pocket now. You better be careful.
I know. I'm like, white magic, dark not magic. So. To some people, that's all kind of the same thing. So maybe you shouldn't magic be like, in pushing it. That.
So the king reminds them, as I said, that she is not on trial here today. And she still finds it hard to condemn Le Comte. I almost said Stanley. Le Comte to death. To keep up the charade and convince them that she doesn't know Raymond, she says she also sees evil in him. And then she goes to the king, and she says she sees it in him because it's in all men. Now, when she's speaking to the king about this, she's a little, I won't say flirty, but she's a little coquettish with him. She's a little bit like, because all men, kingy poo.
No.
Yes, kind of.
She was just flirting with her microphone, and it really bothered me.
Oh, well, yeah, that's disturbing. So the king wants to do some sort of trial by serpent. And Claire is able to, thankfully, change his mind and do the trial by poison.
Which everyone in the room, not by everyone, I mean the Comte and Raymond are like, what? But this is a terrible idea.
This is, what, the poison?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. And that their faces are priceless.
They're like, wait, you wanna, wait, you're going to poison me?
And she goes through some of the evidence brought in for the trial, and she finds what she's looking for, bitter cascara, to poison the men. Now, she says...
How lucky is she that that's one of the vials that was confiscated? Do you know how large his apothecary shop is?
Seriously.
It's huge.
And it may not have been... Because it was from both of their stuff, so it may have been stuff...
There were two tables.
But did one she go was, to his?
Or she went to his.
Okay. So she knows that they'll get sick, but she knows that they won't die. And she hopes it does enough... to bring an end to this trial and to convince the king that, you know, they both got some badness in them or whatever, but that no one will be killed. She puts the bitter cascara into a chalice and first serves Raymond. The look on Raymond's face when she says, we may have a death or two. He's like, what the heck, woman? He's just like, excuse, what?
I mean, he earned this though. Cause you know, he sold the poison that got her the first time.
And Raymond drinks, and he kneels down in pain very convincingly, but overcomes it. Now, my question is, because we learn later on what he does, do you think he kind of overplayed that a little bit so he could kneel and do his thing before recovering-ish?
I'm sure, given the nature of the fact that he knows so much about bitter cascara, he knew what was coming down, so he probably did play it up a little bit. But he probably also played it up more... because he also knew what he put in that glass was going to do to the Comte, and he probably tried to make it look very similar to that.
What the effect would be?
Yeah. And I have been waiting all season for that necklace to turn colors, and it did not disappoint.
Gosh. Oh my gosh, we're going to get there. Oh, okay, we're there.
I was like, we're there.
We're there. When she takes the chalice from him, I think my jaw dropped. I was like, oh, they did it. They did it. I love the effect. I mean, it like swirly turned black. It was perfection.
But it was like, yes. Like just little yes. Tiny spots. And swirlies. All of a sudden it was like, whoa.
Oh my gosh.
And then the Comte sees it.
And he's like, hell no. What? I mean, he's like so disbelieving. Like, he's like, did you just see what happened to her necklace? She's a freaking witch. Hell to the no.
Then he reaches the point where he says,
F it.
He can't. What is he going to do?
What can I do?
He's like, I can't not drink it.
I got nothing to do.
He's like, I drink it, I die. I don't drink it, they kill me. I don't know what else to do. And he's just, the look on his face, and he had that tear in his eye. And again, I reached that point where I almost, I did feel bad for him in this one. And if he had been played by anyone else, I probably might not have felt bad about it. But I felt bad.
She hates to lose a beautiful man.
It's a waste of such a beautiful man.
So,
to die so
if the necklace
grotesquely
in the book too, I don't think it's ever explained. if the necklace wasn't actually touching the drink, right? Mm. It's not inside the cup. How did it change?
I have no idea. Maybe it was like the vapors of it.
Well, I guess it could be a vapors, maybe.
I don't know.
But yeah, that's a question. So as Summer said, LeConte saw his death in that cup.
And he saw his death in that necklace.
Sorry, he did. He's reconciling himself to his death. It was kind of hard to watch. And Louis is a hard ass. He's just like, yeah, it's going to happen. And
he said, I need to make an example of somebody.
And after he dies, he like just steps over his body like, da-da-da.
And he's like, you were lucky, Mr. Raymond. Please leave my country.
The music when LeConte is falling, his final fall or whatever, there's dissonance there, which of course we know Bear likes to use when, not the exact same music, but dissonance was also used when Arthur died, was murdered, was poisoned in, maybe we gotta, well, killed, but they both died by poison.
Is that the poison theme?
No, I said it's not the same music. Oh. It's just there's dissonance in it.
Well, that's too bad. That would have been.
That would have been funny. Of course, Raymond is freed, but he is never to return to France. Now, the most convincing thing yet that Claire is telling someone this story. So think about Outlander. Think about Dragonfly Number or this season one. Think about season two. And then think about what, potentially all of her voiceovers, but think about what she says here.
Is this like a directed meditation right now?
No. Think about what she says as Raymond is leaving.
It's the second reference they've made to The Wizard of Oz this season.
Yes. But when she says something about a film, right? And she says, you know the one, I'm going to miss you most of all. Who is she talking? Not about. Whom is she talking to? Claire, just like in the book, which we don't know yet. Well, in this book, we know. We'll find out. In this season, we'll know. But with all the voiceover, yes, I get it. It's for the audience. But Claire's telling someone this story. Claire is telling someone this story. Just keep that in mind. So then the king gets his payment. He's totally rushing this and there's no prep. Thankfully, they didn't use like the whole rose oil thing where he had to like slip it in, literally
it would
get
have been
her
the
ready.
Second oil ruined by the series.
Oh gosh. But I love the look on her face. It is totally not sexy. And she's just like closing her eyes and going, oh my God, can I please like get her wear?
I mean, it was hysterical. It was almost the same face she had when she was dying on the table in L'Hôpital.
And then once he's done, he gets up and I love how, because of her corsets and everything, she literally like, she doesn't gracefully lay down. She's like, boop. And then when she sits up, she's like, boop, to sit back up. Like,
and she's like,
what are those little toys that just like fall down and come back up?
Weebles.
Yeah. And then she like pops up.
Just like slowly puts her dress back down. She's like,
And then he does, because he talks with his hands, you can't see me doing this, but he's doing a motion of like,
he's like, you're done.
Go, we're done. Shoo fly, don't bother me. And then as she leaves, she takes the orange with her.
And she's like, you already gave that to me. That's mine.
Exactly.
There's not a lot of citrus here.
So here, at this point, I finally looked up orange, the symbolism of the color orange. And it symbolizes energy, vitality, cheer, excitement, adventure, warmth, and good health.
And lack of scurvy.
Yeah, helps with that. We're back at Jared's in Paris, and this is their reunion.
Ugh, this navy charcoal dress. I want it.
And she's in blue. So she returns to Jared, and then Jamie is released, and he returns home. Now, Sam's delivery, we don't even see his face when he says, and his voice is like he hasn't talked for a while, or he's like losing his voice.
Screaming.
Or that. It's kind of crackly, and he says, I don't even know if it was a boy or a girl. That was perhaps his most perfectly delivered line of all the seasons yet, of all the episodes yet. It was perfection. And so, of course, she's telling him what happened. Faith was her name, and she's buried in the cemetery next to the convent. Okay, so the entire flashback scene where they bring the baby to her, and it was so much, so much. And if you want to say anything about that, I want you to go first. And that did not get you as much as that her coming out of the carriage did, right? Just because of, maybe because that other one happened first.
Well, to be honest, by the time this came around, I thought we weren't going to have this moment. I thought they'd cut it out completely because I wrongfully assumed that they would have had that in the beginning. But then when I think back to the book, that's the way they did it in the book too.
Yep.
So I should have known But I don't know. It was really sad. And I was okay until I saw the little tuft of orange hair poking out of the blanket. And then I was
a mess.
Pretty much.
Okay. So as someone who has not given birth to a child.
Yes.
Let alone lost a child. The closest comparison I had to that kind of thing, which is not even a comparison, is of course having lost a pet that I had had for like 16 years. So it's totally different in substance and in circumstance. A number of years ago, I had a very, very beloved pet. So she had been put to sleep. The vet had actually made a home visit and done it at my apartment. So we were surrounded by family and I said goodbye to her. And after she was gone, I kept petting her and talking to her. That sounds hokey, I know. And I just wanted to be with, I know she was gone, but I just wanted to be with her, whatever that shell of her was, as long as I could. I knew that, you know, she needed to go. It lasted a little while. And finally, our dad said to me, just like was said to Claire, it's time, Ginger. And I had to let her go. So he laid her in a small coffin that he built for her. Now, we'd had a few weeks preparation because she'd had cancer. So we knew that it would eventually take her life. The whole point I'm trying to make with this is not about child versus cat. The point I'm trying to make with this is at the point where Claire was able to hold her child, the child already being dead, it was sad and it was beautiful the way they did it. But for even though she knew the child was gone for that, I guess it was all day from the morning until she had to give her up because she said it had been there since she had been holding her since the morning. For the entire time that she was able to hold her, she was able to be connected. She knew she was gone. She knew she wasn't coming back. But it was almost as if she were able to deny it for just a breath. And then when Louise came in and said, it's time, ma chère, and she had to give it up, that is when I think there's nothing to hold on to. When that thing that you love so much, you know is gone, but you can hold it, you can touch it, you can see it, and you know it's real, and then it's taken away, that someone or something that you love, when they're gone and you have to return it to whatever, that's what my point is. Not that it's related to having a human child at all, but when that life is gone, any life is gone, and you know it, but there's that period of time, if you're lucky enough, and I do think it is lucky, if you're lucky enough to be there when you either have to leave the hospital room or when you have to hand over your baby or when you have to hand over a beloved pet, whatever it is that moment when it's gone, but at the point when you have to relinquish it, relinquish the physicality, I think is what I'm trying to say. When you have to relinquish the physicality of this thing you're somehow emotionally connected to, this being that is no longer there, that is what ripped me up. It was sad seeing her with it, right? Seeing the baby and the not the golden, the reddish hair. That was sad and beautiful and just depressing. But when Louise said, it's time, Michelle, you know, there's no recovering from that. When she woke up and she realized she had lost her baby and she was told her baby had died, she still had that chance to see her baby. And once she saw her baby, she held it all day, however long she did. Didn't bring her back, but she could touch it, right? She could touch it and kiss her. And then when your friend has to be called in because you know you're not giving up your baby, right? Because that's it. When you let go, she's gone. You have to face the fact that now she's not only spiritually or life gone, her physicality, the thing you've carried for a mom, is gone. And to me, as sad as it was to watch her cuddling the baby and not being happy, but being able to at least hold her, it was probably one of the most heartbreaking parts of the episode was done so beautifully when Louise like cupped her own belly before she went to Claire and took the child from her and said, she didn't say, okay, gotta go. She says, can I hold her? And that's like, it was a very gentle way of kind of getting in there.
Claire was teetering on madness.
Sure.
It was a very Ophelia scene for me where she was in the world that she'd created that, as long as she had her baby, that there was a chance, you know, it was, uh-huh.
she was in her own little world. And it's, and I agree, the minute that the tether is gone, you know, you have to
face it.
Right. And, you know, unfortunately for that time period, they didn't have cameras. They didn't have any way to record that. And I know a lot of people who have lost children, and some of their most cherished things they have are photographs that were taken of their babies. And Claire would never have that. And she wouldn't have be able to show that to Jamie, and she wouldn't be able to show that to anybody. So you just, all you have is that memory that, that she has in her mind of that day, that one day she got to spend with her baby. And I don't know. I just think there's nothing sadder.
Exactly. And I'm not 100% sure. I'd have to go back and listen, but I think there's a faith theme in and around here. It wasn't as blatant as it was in the carriage, and it wasn't as blatant as it was at the end, but it may have twittered in there. Now, I feel awful for Jamie, but also, of course, for Claire. And then she says she blames herself. She's come like full circle now to like not project it anymore. She's like, I have to take my responsibility for part of this. And she tells him also that she slept with the king. And he says about that, well, look, I had to give myself to someone, or I didn't have to. I gave myself to someone to save your life. This is different circumstance, but same thing. And they say they will go forward together, and maybe they'll have another child. And she says, quote, bring me home to Scotland. And the look on Jamie's face right there when she says, bring me home to Scotland, he looks like he was about to break.
Yeah.
He was about to break. And then he recovers and he says, basically, yeah, let's do it.
Well, he's, I think he's, I mean, clearly he's tired of being in the Bastille, but I think he's also, he's tired of all the intrigue and everything else. Mm-hmm. And he's like, if all that crap is coming,
let's go home.
Let's go home. Let's go home and let's just be with each other and be with family for as long as we can. Cause there's, we, I don't think there's anything else we can do here. All we've done is lost here in France. And that's, and I think she even said, somebody, did they say that? Something about, didn't she have something in a voiceover about something that France was all the things she lost in Paris or something like that?
I remember something about things lost in Paris. Yeah. And then the last scene is at the cemetery near the hospital.
Ugly cry. This is when I was weeping silently in a beautiful way during the homecoming scene, but I full on ugly cried. And I honestly,
was it ugly cry like Notebook?
Oh yeah. Okay. It was like snot coming out of my nose. It was like, it was not pretty. I hate baby tombstones that only have one date on them.
Mm.
They are like the most awful, awful thing to me. I get so sad when I see them in graveyards, when you're, you know, you go to graveyards for whatever reason, you're walking around and you see the tombstones that just have one date on them. And I just think of just the loss and how they never got to do anything. And it just makes me sad. And
thanks
I
a lot, like Tony.
Yeah, thanks, Tony.
And Diana, because ultimately, you know. So this, heck yeah, big time faith theme here. Big time. And I, this I wrote, this is almost too hard to watch. It really is. I don't, yeah. It, like some people won't watch 116 or 115.
I'm going to go further than that. This is my Schindler's List.
Oh,
I could only watch Schindler's List once. It was a fantastic movie, but it was, I can't watch it again.
You won't watch this one again?
I have had to watch it twice now.
I know,
and
you're done.
I don't know if I can watch it again. I,
with your daughter sitting next to you?
years from now. I'm the only way that I would ever watch this again right now is if I started a rewatch of the whole series.
And you had to watch
And you have to watch everything in order. But right now, this is, I can't put my, like, I've watched it twice, and both times I wept horrifically and ugly in different parts. And it was exactly the same. I'm like, I can't do that to my body again right now.
Yeah. When they put the St. Andrew's Apostle spoon next to their grave, just beautiful, beautiful theme. Thank you, Bear, again. And the name, I mean, we know what the name is, but to see the words or the name Faith Fraser on the stone. And then it ends with her left, she totally doubles over in mourning and racking with sobs, most likely. And then, of course, the aerial kind of overhead shot kind of backs up. And it ends with her left hand on the grave. So remember that I said in the opening, she's on the right side of Bree and it's her right hand, the kid who might be Bree. She's on the right side of the child and her right hand is therefore on top of the book. And that's the hand we see with the nail polish here. And it may have no meaning whatsoever. It could just be the blocking. But here, it's also her child. And I didn't write down if she's in blue. This is the one time I didn't. I don't know. She's got like a dark, probably black, like
it
a
looked
veil
brown.
On.
It was yeah. brown with like a dark black lace.
But she's on the left and it's her left hand as opposed to the right. But it's also her child. So yeah, I notice things and they may not have any purpose. But now I'm just like too conditioned to think about everything, I guess, or think about too much. So basically, if there's any doubt whom our favorite writer is, that Ginger is a masochist, and that DIA is her favorite book, episode 207 sealed it all. Yes, it's Tony. Yes, she is. And yes, it still is. So what an amazing...
I'm going to need a season 3 to palate cleanse this episode.
Oh, girl, season 2 ain't over yet.
That's what I'm saying.
Oh, so you need a season 3 to palate cleanse of season 2.
Yeah, but right now...
Not just that.
Right now, I need an announcement of season 3 to palate cleanse.
Oh, I didn't hear that. I thought you meant actually getting 3, like watching 3.
I need all of those things, but I definitely need it now, and I'll need it more later.
So what amazing teamwork. Of course, you need writer, director, actors, everybody in production putting this together, but I got... Katrina has to have some kind of nomination. She has to have some kind of nomination for this. This was ridiculous. I mean, I don't know what to say, but I guess I've already said it
several times.
So that was 207. Probably, yeah, that was for me more intense or harder to get through. Maybe not to talk about, but to get through than 115 or 116. Completely different, but disturbing in a different way. Definitely more emotional, I think.
Yeah.
So I'm almost afraid to ask, but let us know what your thoughts were for 207. This is like opening floodgates here.
No, I just want you all to call in and just weep. And we'll just cry. And we'll just post like like 5 minutes of
we'll
crying.
We'll play your weeping over our theme music as our...
Can we auto-tune it so it sounds like... So. Yeah.
No. No, we will not auto-tune weeping. Aww. So yeah, give us a call. Let us know what you thought of 207, what you thought of our discussion of 207. Is there anything among all the dresses or among all the symbolism that I missed or that we missed? Again, please keep comments. I know this is hard because this is so emotional and people do want to share and we want you to share. But please try and keep comments close to 90 seconds. And our number again, 916-604-4777. And we really, really, really would like to hear from you, especially about this episode, because I can't say anything about future because we don't want to spoil the season, even though we haven't read the scripts or anything, but we know what happens in the book. And so they're most likely keeping most of it. So we don't want to spoil what happens in the book, but this may or may not be the most difficult episode of the season, but it's up there. It's definitely up there. So, we know if it affected us, we know it's affected you. So let us know what you thought. And especially let us know what you thought about Tony's writing. So thank you as always so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode.
Thank you to our generous audio host, audioboom.com. Our audioboom channel is www.audioboom.com/channel/outlanderpod. Visit our website at www.outlanderpod.com. Follow us on Twitter @outlanderpod. Find us on Facebook at www.facebook.com/outlanderpod or email us at outlanderpod@gmail.com.